We were living in a tent, a canvas tent at the time, because when we moved here, of course, we didn't have a house. But my dad was building his own house out of cardboards and stuff like that, what he could get in terms of materials around town. He gathered together and put a sort of half house and a half traditional hut.
Welcome back to the Nature Stories podcast. I'm Samantha Brown. Just a few generations ago, most Inuit families lived in tents in small nomadic communities. This week, the Nature Stories podcast explores how the lives of the Inuit are quickly changing. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection of people and place. Up now, The Tent, produced by Michelle Ernsting with Radio Netherlands. My name is Naki. I was named after my older sister. Naki is my Inuit name, and Lena is my Christian name. I'm not quite 90 yet. I think I'm in my late 80s. I've forgotten now. I don't keep track of my age anymore. Blacklead Island is where I was born. It was a whaling station just outside the settlement of Pangnutang. There were various hunting camps around Pangnutang, and they were quite small, maybe 5 families. It fluctuated. People would move around, but there were usually 5 core families. My childhood was very joyful. We children played a lot, and we played by mimicking our parents. We didn't have man-made store-bought toys. We played with natural things around us. Certain rocks would be tents, and others would be kayaks. Earth might be snow, and we pretended sand was sugar and the grass was tea. Because we mimicked our parents from a very early age, we could easily play their role when it was our time. We were very happy, but we worked hard to get things. For instance, during the winter, we picked berries in the snow. We would carry bags, you know, those cotton flour sacks, and we would hold them in our teeth so that we could pick frozen berries with 2 hands. Looking back on it, it must have been hard, but I remember being so happy to bring those berries back to our house. My mother was a very strong provider. She played both male and female roles very well. She had a dog team of her own, and she was always hunting. Life depended on what was available that particular year. We hunted sea mammals, and we were determined to feed ourselves. During the summer, when animals were scarce, we dug for clams. Sometimes we got a bit of rice from the whalers, and we made that last so we could feed as many little children as possible. We rationed everything, never wasted a thing. I remember my mother and my grandmother very well because they are the ones who taught me these values. The community was very small, and women had to work closely. That's how my mother got to know my husband's mother. They proposed that we marry because my husband had the necessary hunting skills and could provide for me. I had good sewing skills and could make him warm clothes. So it was through an arranged marriage that I met my husband. In my case, it was sort of eased in. I was not immediately spending time with him. First, he met the people I associated with, and then they took him along to a major caribou hunt. It was then that we were introduced. I accepted it because that's how marriage worked in those days. Our house was very comfortable. Of course, it wasn't as big as the houses that we see today. I guess today you would call it a hut. But it was very warm and comfortable. It was made of sealskin, dried sealskin, sewn together. Many sealskins sewn together. And we used natural things, like heather, to insulate it. Many people lived in the hut. I had 6 daughters and 2 sons, though they aren't alive today. So there were 10 of us altogether, and then many more, because I took in a lot of boarders. People from the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they came out once a year. They looked after the Inuit on behalf of the government. It was a good and happy experience to have the Southerners visiting. We were always joyful to see them, because they were there to help us. With all those people, you might think our house was a noisy place. But you have to remember that children in those days were very well disciplined. Back then, children were raised in a very calm, quiet environment. We never allowed children to play indoors. It was also a discipline measure to get them outside, to turn them into good, strong survivors, because our lifestyle was based on survival. My children never disobeyed me. They knew what their role was from the time they were small. We always knew what our children were up to. It's not like today where people live in many rooms and they don't know what their children are doing. We moved to Iqaluit by dog team in 1957. My husband went first and then we followed. I resisted at first. We couldn't bring all our belongings and I was very attached to my things and to my home. Eventually I had to give in to pressure from relatives who were living in the town. In those days, Inuit weren't used to living in a large community, only in small camps. Our life was very silent and calm, and we lived it to the fullest. When you live in a small group, your society is not out of control. People today live in a very fast world. We lived quietly and joyfully, and that reflected in our children. But that's not what you see today.
I am Mary Echo Wellman. I'm daughter of Naki Echo and mother of Naomi Wellman. Yeah. We came here in spring, so actually you would not travel during the day because the snow at that time is quite slush. And with a heavy load like that, it was best to travel at night when the weather cooled down and the snow got crisp. So we would travel more at night and then rest during the day. There are highlights of my childhood during that journey. As we were approaching Iqaluit, close by, the first thing we saw was the lights, beautiful lights. And thinking back now, in those days, Iqaluit had a military base, army base, and that's what we saw, lights, and when we were coming in. This was in 1957. I must have been around 9. Iqaluit, Frobisher Bay, it was called at that time, seemed so huge. It seemed there were already so many people living. The lifestyle here was quite different to what we had been used to. We came here all clothed in traditional outfits. Traditional, I mean, in sealskins and caribou and kamiks. All our gear was like that. Kids here were already not used to seeing. There were a lot of southern materials. So as a child, as a kid, everything's beautiful. The southern bought clothings, we thought they were beautiful. We were living in a tent, a canvas tent at the time, because when we moved here, of course, we didn't have a house, but my dad was building his own house out of cardboards and stuff like that, what he could get in terms of materials around town. He gathered together and put a sort of half house and a half traditional hut. When we moved here, Mom and Dad were told some of their kids were of school age and that it was government policy and procedure to have children go to school. Otherwise, they would not be eligible to receive family allowance. So my mom and dad said, you now have to go to school. For me, it was extremely exciting. I always had the strong desire to learn English. We didn't speak in English when we moved to Iqaluit. It was all in Inuktitut. And of course, I wanted to be where the kids were.
Inyalagit means sit down, sit down. I thought it's don't be too loud.
Have to sit down. The first residential school that was created for Inuit was in Fort Churchill, northern Manitoba, by federal government. And it was to gather all the children who had the potential and the age to continue school. So in those days, it took us 8 to 12 hours by plane. I think it's more than 2,300 miles from where we are. The initial 3 months were the hardest, and bedtime would be the worst for some reason. Once you bypass that phase, everything was positive. There were some really good, well-meaning supervisors who watched over you. There was no abuse. We were loved. I mean, love comes in different forms and different ways. But it was English love, like, you know what I mean? No one can replace your own mom and dad.
Wow, I looked around and it's like Elias reading quietly. That's so lovely.
But because you understand what the purpose was, and that was to cope in a economy world, really. We understood that very well. We were clearly getting caught in the two worlds, in the two cultures. And it clashed at times. That's what I have found difficult. And because the English world is very strong influence, that's the world I wanted to be in. But I also wanted to be in my mom and dad's world, because that's what I knew best. I don't remember really bad issues while I was growing up here in Iqaluit. It is only now, knowing the influences, you know, the television, the drinking. There was a liquor store when we were growing up here. That must have been quite a sad movement for people here. And it has had really bad impact on the children. Even good, what were intended to be good, like introducing social welfare, when Inuit were so much independent, to introduce payments without a job, just to be in a community, so it's easier for the government to administer, created dependency. We are the survivors of the North. My parents did. They survived. Their generation and their generation before them and generations way before that. So to come here and not give that a thought first and foremost, I think was the biggest mistake.
I'm Naomi Willman. I am the granddaughter of Naki Echo and the daughter of Mary Echo Willman. And I am the mother of Isaac Willman. I think I was about five. My brother was being taken care of by my grandmother in the afternoon. I kind of find it strange saying grandmother. I never call her grandmother, and I'll just refer to her as my nun itself. That's what she is in Inuktitut. She had one of those old Singer sewing machines, and she made tents. She made big white canvas tents. And I remember just sitting underneath this big tent over me and over this sewing machine and just kind of being in the tent as she was making it and getting in trouble from her because I shouldn't be anywhere near the spinning belt and all this stuff. So
dads, this is your day to shop at Yukon Gardens. All fathers buying any hanging baskets get them for half price just for being a dad.
TV kind of portrayed a beautiful picture of, you know, Southern living. Everything from TV, video games, influences from the school. I mean, it wasn't a negative influence to be taught all in all by white teachers, but there was no Inuit cultural presence there, other than, you know, a trip here or there on the land every year and a sewing room. Inuit teachers were still educating themselves, and some just, you know, couldn't handle the school.
Mary, Michael,
Around my time in high school, I remember there being a lot of kind of discipline problems, like there maybe just lack of rules or, you know, at home. Ekhaledin has changed so much. It's just been in constant construction mode and constant change mode. And a lot of change has been southern pushed and southern based. And as I said before, it's not always bad, but I think it's really kind of taken its toll on my generation, as well as, you know, maybe people a little older than me. I was lucky I had my mom and my grandmother who clearly explained personal, actual stories from my grandmother of the whalers coming and things like that. Not everybody knows about that. And some people are just finding themselves here and not knowing, just knowing, yeah, my parents and my grandparents lived on the land, but if you put me out there, I would not be able to survive. I don't know how to hunt. I don't know how to provide for my family. I can speak Inuktitut, but where does that put me as an Inuk? And it was kind of obvious to me that some people coming from that, it was a result of their parents kind of being in the confused state as well, maybe turning to alcoholism to cope. Every other person that you'll meet in some way or other is affected by suicide. That's another huge coping method. They don't. Anybody that I've ever spoken to at the youth center that has been suicidal goes back to, I can't do anything. I don't have enough skills to work. I don't have enough skills to be a real Inuk. I've quit school. My parents are too busy doing something else. Therefore, I'm not really needed. I had a cousin who committed suicide for, you know, that reason. You could see he was couldn't really figure out where he's supposed to be and where he fits in this picture. When I went south to go to school, very difficult decision to make, and it was something that I had to do. I had to, you know, I'm finished high school now, I have to go off and educate myself more. Very young, you know. It was very, very difficult. I can't even describe the feeling of, you know, getting on the plane in Ottawa and just knowing in 3 hours I am going to be home. And within, you know, 2 hours of being off the plane, you just feel like you have never left again, you know, like you see your family, and that was one of the big things is, okay, go see mom, see dad, see my brother, go see my aunt, my aunts and uncles, okay, now I'm really back. After I had my son, it became more obvious to me what kinds of struggles you might have. When I had him, something came over me. I've always considered myself Inuk, and I've always been very interested in my own culture, but I'm not absolutely fluent in my own language, so the urgency for me to be able to gain the fluency so that I could pass it on to my son as well. I want to get to the point where I can converse with my son completely in Inuktitut, and I'm hoping that will happen, but I also am very nervous that there's not a lot of time for... I'm a single mom, so with work and school, and, you know, now I'm going to be going to school in the fall, where am I going to find this time? So it's just one of those sitting on the fence, nerve-wracking things. My son is named after my grandmother's sister, something that is very unique to the Inuit culture and the naming of somebody, and you just become that person. His name is Kudlu, and he is the sister of my grandmother, so that's what she calls him. And he doesn't call her his great-grandmother. He calls her Nayakuluk, which is his sister. And he understands the whole reasoning behind that, and he understands why the person who was my midwife calls me Mom, because I was named after her mom. And as a small child, he just couldn't understand, why does he call you Mom? And it's so such a funny thing to see coming from my son and explaining that to my son, because the exact same thing 20 years before was happening to me. I just recently got my own tent from my mother, so it's one of those things that, you know, maybe now because I'm a mother, I can have my own tent. But I don't know, as far back as I can remember, and it's been our own little community out there, my mother and my aunt and a couple of her close friends. We take our homemade canvas tents out there, and it's quiet. It's away from this hustle-bustle of 9-to-5 work day. And my grandmother just really enjoys getting back out. That's her time of the year where she can just be out on the land and smell the heather, and it's just such a sweet smell. We make tea, we make supper, we just be out there and enjoy being on the land. I do all those things. Run around with my son, running after little lemmings and birds. That's what last year consisted of.
That piece was produced by Michelle Ernsting with Radio Netherlands. If you'd like to hear more pieces like this one, go to the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. The Nature Conservancy provides support for this podcast. Online at nature.org/stories. Committed to protecting nature and preserving life. If you have thoughts or feedback, please send it to podcast@tnc.org. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown. Join us next week.